Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, welcome to the Tuesday Night Bible Study, coming to you live from the Potter's House and Tank Ministries. I'm your host, Andy Young. I am sitting here in my broadcast studio, also known as my office. I should say my wife's office, because I am sitting here surrounded literally by piles of books and lesson plans and grade reports and what else, all kinds of things. My wife uses this office for homeschooling our kids. I originally made this office. This actually wasn't supposed to be my workspace so I could work from home, but that never really worked out, and so my wife needed a place to homeschool the kids once we started doing that, and so she's taken over this space for herself, which is fine. You know, I'm not going to begrudge her that. It works out great for her. I'm glad to let her have this space to use for doing homeschooling with. But my wife is working diligently right now to get everything ready for classes. She wants to start homeschooling next week. So start homeschooling classes with the kids next week. So she's got... Oh, she's trying to get everything organized, and there's just piles of stuff everywhere here, and she's got portfolio reviews to put together to submit things to the state and so forth. And, you know, I'm just thankful that I don't have to deal with that, because I don't think that I am that organized that I can keep on top of all that stuff like that. So my hat's off to her. She really works hard with everything that she does here. I kid people. I have to go to work to relax. My wife's got the harder job than what I do. She stays home with all these kids all day and homeschools them. So my job, I think, is infinitely easier compared to what she does. So I just want to give her credit for that, and I'm very thankful for her, for the wonderful woman that God has given me to be my wife, a wonderful helpmeet that she is for me. I just love her so much. I'm thankful for her. So anyway, the phone number, if you'd like to be a part of the program tonight, is area code 347-855-8317. That's area code 347-855-8317. You can join us on Skype if you have a Skype account. That is, I believe, a free account, a free call for you to connect using your Skype account. Just click on the Skype button there that you see on the program screen. Our email address is mail@ttank.com. That's mail@ttank.com. Feel free to send us an email message. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know how you like the program, either this lesson or any of the programs that you listen to here on the False Reformation Station on Blog Talk Radio. You can also make comments on the program screen by scrolling down towards the bottom, and you'll see a place there where you can. Our text for tonight, go ahead and take your Bibles, and you can turn to Acts chapter 23. Acts chapter 23. Tonight we're going to be covering verses 31 through verse 23 of chapter 24. Let me say that again. Our text is going to be Acts chapter 23, verse 31, all the way through chapter 24, verse 23. Got that straight? Okay, now while you're turning there, one of the constant themes that we have seen during our study of the book of Acts, and particularly in this last half of the book, while we've been studying Paul's missionary journeys. Is the attempt of religion to use the force of government to enforce its orthodoxy, its traditions? We've seen where certain groups of Jews will go around and incite the local people into rioting. Certain groups of Jews who will make up false accusations about what Paul is teaching. There have been times when Paul was run out of a city. We saw once where he was even stoned. The crowd of people dragged him out of the gates of the city, and once outside the city, they proceeded to stone him and left him for dead. We saw in Corinth how the Jewish leaders brought Paul before Gallio, the governor of that province of Achaia. The Jews brought him before Gallio in an attempt to have him silenced. And more recently, as our narrative takes us back to Jerusalem now, we see the high priests and the elders accusing Paul before a Roman captain. So we've got this recurring theme. And what is interesting is that in these last two occasions that I mentioned, both before Gallio and also the accusations brought before this Roman captain, in these last two occasions, the local authorities show great discernment in these matters. Both Gallio and this Roman captain, whose name was Claudius Lysias, they both recognize that Paul hasn't broken any civil or criminal laws. They recognize, and rightly so, that the whole dispute is nothing more than a matter of religious differences. In the case with Gallio, he unceremoniously dismisses the Jewish leaders from his judgment hall. And then he conveniently turns a blind eye while the local enforcers, if we want to call them that, enforcers proceed to beat those Jewish leaders in retaliation for trying to cause trouble in their city. And Gallio just kind of turns a blind eye, pretends he doesn't see it going on. He kind of gives his tacit approval there for letting these people retaliate against these Jewish leaders for trying to cause trouble. In the case with Lysias, Claudius Lysias takes steps to protect Paul from the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who begin to argue violently over Paul. Once they come to the realization that Lysias isn't going to let them have their way with him, you know, and Paul becomes at risk of being torn to pieces by these guys. So this is where we find Paul. He's back in protective custody of the Roman captain, Claudius Lysias, who has just learned of an attempted conspiracy between a group of about 40 Jews and the high priests and the elders as well. These men want to set up an ambush, to ambush Paul and kill him. And so Lysias musters an army of about 470 soldiers and horsemen, spearmen, to escort Paul immediately to Caesarea to preserve his life, and also so that Governor Felix can hear the case in his judgment hall. And so the last time we ended the lesson, we ended the lesson with this letter that Lysias wrote to Felix, the governor there, and sent this along with Paul. And so that brings us now to our text for tonight. So let's begin with verse 31, chapter 23, verse 31. You can follow along with me as I read. Acts chapter 23, verse 31. Then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. On the morrow they left the horsemen to go with him and returned to the castle, who, when they had come to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, "I will hear thee," he said, "when thine accusers are also come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. There are two reasons why Lysias sent such a large contingent with Paul. And we talked about this in the last lesson. The first we know about, it was for his own protection, to protect him from these conspirators who wanted to kill him. Now notice that he sent them by night. And we know it was after sunset because we were told earlier that Lysias assembled this army, it said about the third hour of the night. So that would be about 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. He wanted to get Paul away from Jerusalem as soon as possible. Now, back in those days, people never traveled at night. You only wanted to travel during the daytime. And why was that? The most obvious reason was because if you traveled at night, when you get outside the protection of the city, you're out in the wilderness area. You've got bandits and robbers who lurk the roads in these unpopulated areas. You always took the risk, even if you were traveling in the daytime, but you never wanted to travel at night because the risk was so high of being robbed. So this large army would have afforded protection from this as well. So they had no issue traveling at night, not with 470 soldiers escorting them. I don't think any bandits or robbers in their right mind is going to attack a caravan of 470 Roman soldiers. So they escort Paul as far as Antipatris. Now, if you look at the program screen, you'll see in the slideshow window there that I've included a map of the province of Judea. And in that map, you'll see Jerusalem highlighted, and you'll see Caesarea over on the coast of the Mediterranean. I've also highlighted Antipatris. Now, I don't know if the scale of miles is located there in that picture, because I cropped this out from a larger map, so I don't know if I've included the scale of miles on that. But Antipatris is about 20 to 25 miles west-northwest of Jerusalem. And then it's probably another 10 miles from there to Caesarea. So it would have taken them most of the night to travel from Jerusalem to Antipatris. 20 to 25 miles is the typical distance that anyone would travel in a given day anyway, from sunup to sundown. So here at night, leaving at 9 o'clock at night, it would have taken them 8, 10 hours maybe to travel that 20 to 25 miles to Antipatris. That's most of the night. Okay. Verse 32 says, on the morrow, or tomorrow, the next day. And the implication, you kind of get the implication that they reached Antipatris at night and they rested a little bit. And then the sun came up. But in reality, I think it's already morning by the time they get there, by the time they get to Antipatris. So now, believing then that Paul is safely far enough away from the conspirators, they don't have to worry about traveling at night anymore because it is now daytime. The foot soldiers, so you got the infantrymen and the spearmen, they return to Jerusalem, back to their barracks. And the cavalry then continue on with Paul to escort him all the way back, all the rest of the way to Caesarea. Now notice that Felix asks about where Paul comes from. Felix is the governor of this province of Judea. And you can see that there in the map. There's that colored area. You can see that colored area. That is the province of Judea. And Felix is the governor of that region. So why does he ask Paul about what province he was from? Is this a matter of jurisdiction? I don't think so. This would have been a civil matter that occurred in Judea, and so it would have been under Felix's jurisdiction anyway. So I don't think this is, he's asking Paul about where he comes from as a matter of trying to determine jurisdiction. Not a whole lot is made about this point in the text. It almost seems to be an afterthought. But look at the phrase here in verse 34. In verse 34, it says, when he understood that he was of Cilicia. That word that's translated understood is the Greek word puthanomai. Puthanomai. It means to question or to ascertain by inquiry. Let me say that again. Puthanomai. It means to question or to ascertain by inquiry. And what this phrase is telling us is that Felix made an inquiry into Paul's background. I think the implication here is that Paul clearly told him that he was from Cilicia, and Felix simply did a background check. You know, he was the Roman governor of that province. He could have easily checked the official records of Roman citizens, and he would have discovered that, yes, indeed, not only was Paul from Cilicia, but Paul was also a Roman citizen. So I think the purpose here in verse 34 is just to establish once again how Paul's treatment while in Roman custody would be contingent on his status as a Roman citizen. And so because of this, this affords him a great deal of latitude. And we'll see that later on as we get to the end of the lesson. Now notice what Felix does here. He commands Paul to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. Herod's judgment hall. Now the word kept here, this is the Greek word phulasso. Phulasso. It means to guard or to watch. This word has an idea of isolation to it. It's almost the idea of, like the tower in a castle is sometimes called a keep. And it's, what is it? It isolates, whoever is in it is isolated from whatever is outside and it's protected. That's the idea behind this word phulasso, a keep or a guard or to guard or to watch. So it appears that Felix is taking seriously this threat to Paul's life. This is not for the purpose like Felix is worried that Paul is going to escape or Paul is going to try and get out of custody. Okay, he's not worried about Paul trying to escape. He's worried about keeping Paul safe. And I think, and that's clear to us in this word phulasso. Okay, he's being guarded, he's being isolated, protected. And look where he puts him. Look where he puts him. He puts him in Herod's judgment hall. Now you talk about a secure location. Anyone is going to have a tough time getting to Paul there. And, you know, being in Herod's judgment hall, I believe this is probably very close to his palace as well. That's a pretty posh place for him to be staying, don't you think? So here, you know, I think, again, this is going to attest to Paul's treatment as a Roman citizen. He doesn't put him in a jail. He doesn't put him in a dungeon somewhere. He puts him in Herod's judgment hall for protection. So far, Felix seems to be a very reasonable governor. He's being very consistent with his treatment of Paul as a Roman citizen. And I think this is important to note. Paragraph. Now we move into chapter 24. All right, verse 1 of chapter 24. And after 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, descended with the elders. Okay, that's going to be the Sanhedrin. Okay, elders here is a reference to the Sanhedrin, which are the elected representatives for the Jewish people. And there's going to be, you're going to have in this council of the Sanhedrin, you're going to have those who are both Pharisees and Sadducees. Ananias, the high priest, descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. When he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always, and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness." Okay, so we got this very grandiose introduction, playing all these platitudes upon Felix and so forth. So before we go on, we have a couple of individuals introduced here. First, we have Ananias the high priest. Now, there's some disagreement on Ananias about when he served as high priest. Some sources record him as serving as high priest for 12 years, from the years 47 to 59 AD. And that would fit in with our timeline. We've been sort of keeping an unofficial timeline here as we go through, as we've been going through our study of the book of Acts. And we learn later on, we're not going to get to this tonight, but in the next lesson, we learn that Paul remains in custody for 2 years until Festus becomes governor in 60 AD. That would put us right now in the year 58 AD at this point in our study. Okay, so we're at 58, we're around 58 AD. But history also records, I thought this was interesting, that Ananias, this high priest, was arrested in 52 AD for suspicions of participating in some ambiguous violent acts. There was nothing, I couldn't find anything specific, whether it had to do with some kind of uprising against Rome or some other criminal violent acts like an assault or murder or something. I don't know. Nothing was specified. But he was arrested in 52 AD, and he was taken to Rome for trial. And he was eventually pardoned by Caesar. So what's unclear then is whether he remained high priest or if there were others who stood in his place during that time. There are other individuals listed as serving as high priest between the years 52 and 60 AD. So, like I said, there's this confusion between, depending on what historical source you look at. Here in our text, he could simply be referred to as high priest by title. You know, when a president, you know, after a president serves his term, we still refer to that person as president such and such. He's not currently president. He was president, but we still refer to him by that title. Perhaps Ananias, even though he might not currently be serving as high priest, is still known by that title, even though he's not necessarily serving that capacity. So then we have Tertullus. Tertullus. The translation here calls him an orator. The Greek word is the word rhetor. Rhetor. From this we get the word like rhetoric. Okay? Now we often think of rhetoric as just meaningless phrases, okay, or like sound bites, okay, or catchphrases that people use. You know, some people might just start to say, "Oh, he's just spouting rhetoric." You know, it's, well, you know, phrases designed to get people inspired or encourage people to take some kind of action. Sometimes we think of rhetoric in those terms. But in the academic world, there is such a thing as the study of rhetoric, and that has to do with things like debating, presenting arguments, okay, proving a case. What's that sound like? Okay. In this context, Tertullus would be acting as a forensic or a legal advocate, or what in our culture we know as the lawyer. Okay? So he's a lawyer. It is unclear, though, whether Tertullus is a Jew or a Gentile. Speculate that he might be a Hellenistic Jew. In any case, these Jewish leaders have hired Tertullus to represent them. He's going to be the one to present their case to Felix. And he's the lawyer in the room. Now let's look at these charges. And let me back up a little bit and start in the middle of verse 2. Tertullus is speaking, seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency a few words. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took, and would have judged according to our law. But the chief captain, Lysias, came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come unto thee, by examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. And the Jews also assented, saying that, yes, these things were so. Okay, so Tertullus makes all these accusations, and the Jews, the high priests, and the Sanhedrin, they're nodding and says, yep, well, everything he said, yep, we got it, what he said. What are the charges? What are the charges? Well, first of all, that Paul was causing a disturbance around the Roman Empire. Okay. What did he mean by that? Was he referring just to the local province there, Jerusalem? Or is he referring to a much larger context, like everywhere Paul went? Okay. This accusation would have been an offense against the Roman government itself. It was a serious offense to cause a riot. We've seen that before. When we were studying Acts chapter 19, you saw what happened there in Ephesus. The whole account with the individuals who were making the silver shrines for Diana. And there was this great uproar. And you remember the one man got in the middle and he said, we're in danger of being called into account today because of this uproar. This is not a lawful assembly. We have to have a lawful assembly. We can't be rioting. If we're going to gather together, we have to do it lawfully. So it was a serious offense to cause a riot. More than that, he called Paul a mover of sedition among the Jews. So in other words, he was accusing Paul of inciting the Jews to revolt against Rome. Okay? Working against the government. Another serious charge. Also part of this was that Paul was attempting to prevent the free exercise of the Jews' religion. The Roman government at this time prided itself on being very tolerant of other religions and allowing the free practice of other religions so long as it did not incite any kind of revolt against the government or any kind of sedition. You could practice whatever religion you wanted to as long as you did not try to incite sedition against the government. So this kind of disturbance, their claim here is that these disturbances that Paul is making it difficult for Jews to practice their religion. So the Roman government would look not too kindly on that. They're interested in free exercise of religion. They're not going to look too kindly on someone who's trying to prevent someone from practicing their religion. But the other charge was that of profaning the temple. Now, what is interesting here is that Rome allowed the Jews to punish someone for this. They had the freedom to do that. And I think, again, that goes back to being tolerant of other people practicing their religion. They allowed the Jews some leeway when it came to the temple. If somebody was profaning the temple, the Jews had the authority to carry out punishment against somebody for doing that. So these charges that Tertullus lays against Paul are not only serious, but they are legitimate crimes. Okay? Now I say legitimate only in a technical case, in the technical sense. I'm not saying here that they're legitimate as if they had any actual merit or proof, or that Paul was actually guilty of these things. Okay? But these charges are actual legitimate crimes that someone could be charged with. Okay, so this is nothing spurious that they're doing here. I mean, now we can go back and examine each one of these charges. Okay, yes, it's true, and we studied this. Everywhere that Paul went, that chaos seemed to follow him. But was this because Paul was the cause? No. In fact, we see that in each instance where there was a disturbance, where Paul happened to be in the middle of it, in each instance, who was it? It was the Jews that incited the people to riot. It was nothing that Paul did, but you can already see now how Tertullus is trying to spin this in his favor. Was Paul responsible for profaning the temple? No, he wasn't. The only people he took into the temple with him were the four others who had taken that Nazarite vow with him. But it was the Jews from Asia who made this assertion that Paul brought Gentiles into a forbidden area of the temple simply because they had seen him with these traveling companions with him earlier. They had seen Paul earlier in Jerusalem with Gentiles. Now they see Paul in the temple, and they just automatically assume, oh, he's brought these Gentiles in the temple with him. Okay, he's profaning the temple. You can see how these facts get cloudy and how they spin them to make their case against Paul. They take the truth, they distort it, they twist it, make it fit their narrative. And notice the utter contempt that Tertullus has for Paul. He calls him the ringleader of the Nazarenes. Now this is actually this phrase here is actually shorthand to refer to disciples of Jesus of Nazareth. So the identification is being made directly with being a follower of Jesus. Okay? So by calling Paul a Nazarene and his all the other people that are the part of this that are disciples like Paul, and Paul's the ringleader of them. These are all Nazarenes. They're these ones that follow Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, the connection, the identification is being made there with this term Nazarenes. And it's telling that he calls them Nazarenes instead of Christians. Remember, Christians was already a pejorative term. He could have easily called them Christians and have been just as insulting. But Tertullus doesn't even want to use that term Christians, because this term Christ is Greek for anointed. It's the Greek term for Messiah. So it is as if he doesn't even want to use any term that would come anywhere close to implying that Jesus was the Messiah. That Paul is the ringleader of a group of individuals who are followers of the Messiah. He stays away from it. Okay? He doesn't even want to make that association that Jesus was the Messiah. So he stays away from it, and he refers to them as Nazarenes instead. So notice that not only does Tertullus bring charges against Paul, he accuses Claudius Lysias as well. You see that? He brings an accusation against this very noble, very diligent Roman captain. He says that, hey, all we were trying to do was charge Paul for profaning the temple. The law allows us to do this. We were just trying to carry out punishment against him. Then Lysias got in the way. Claudius Lysias kept them from doing what was lawful for them to do. And not only that, while we're in the middle of trying to carry out this lawful judgment against Paul, Lysias comes along with great violence, he takes Paul away from us. With great violence. How dare he? But is that what really happened? No. Remember the Jews. It was the Jews that had gotten the crowd all riled up into a frenzy. And once they got outside the temple, out there on the steps in front of the main entrance to the temple, there were two sides arguing and shouting back and forth at each other. They didn't even know what they were arguing about. It was just a mob scene. And poor Paul is caught right in the middle of it. This was no lawful assembly. Okay? This was no lawful assembly. This was a riot that Lysias came upon, not a peaceful assembly. Lysias was just trying to stop the riot. Lysias was doing his job. And in doing his job, custody to find out, to try and get to the bottom of what the problem was. Why are these people rioting? Why is this Paul caught in the middle of it? Who is this person? Why are they fighting over him? I got to stop this riot. This is not lawful. This is not how we behave ourselves in the Roman society. And so now with these accusations against Lysias, we're going to see that at the end of tonight's text that Felix realizes he's not going to be able to make any judgment until Lysias is there to defend himself. So now, Paul gets a chance to state his case once again. Let's look at the next paragraph. Verse 10. Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned unto him to speak, answered. Now this is Paul speaking. For as much as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for to worship, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues nor in the city. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. So Paul cuts right to the heart of this matter, doesn't he? We just looked at the accusations, and we compared them to the actual events, and we were very easily able to see right through the spin. And Paul does the same thing here. He cuts right to the accusations. First off, he says, I've only been home for 12 days. But Tertullus has made it sound as if Paul has been here for quite some time, trying to stir up sedition. He says, I only went to the temple to worship. I went there to observe Pentecost. That's why I was there. I wasn't disputing with anyone. I didn't go in there I didn't go to any synagogue for the purpose of disputing the scriptures, of talking about Jesus. I went there to worship, to observe Pentecost. And not only that, they have no proof. They have no witnesses. They can't prove any of these accusations that they're making against me. Let's go on. Verse 14. But this I confess unto thee. Remember that word confess means to say the same. Okay? To say the same. All these accusations are false. But I do agree with this one thing. Okay, I will confess this. I will confess unto thee that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all the things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. Now notice in verse 14, Paul's use of that expression, the way. Remember, this is how believers were known, followers of the way. And Paul makes it a point to explain that these religious leaders call it heresy, but this way that Paul is being accused of is exactly what the Old Testament scriptures prophesied about. If they knew their Old Testament scriptures as much as they did, as well as they did, interpreted them properly, the Old Testament would speak of this way, is what Paul's trying to say. I'm not doing anything different than what the scriptures have prophesied. We also have here a definition of worship. I want you to see this. This is something else we talked about before. And I won't get into the details about this again because we've covered this. But there is this notion in modern Christianity, in Protestantism, notion that worship is something that's done at church. What do we do at church? We go to church to worship God. Why are we in church? We're here to worship. You hear that all the time, over and over. Or that we worship when we are gathered together in church. But then you have the whole account in John 4. And this is a part I'm referring to. We talked about this before. And I'm not going to get into depth here for sake of time. Where Jesus told the woman at the well that worship doesn't happen at a place. She said, our fathers worship in this mountain, but you people down there in Jerusalem say that in Jerusalem is where you're supposed to worship. And Jesus said, basically, worship doesn't happen in a place. Worship happens in spirit and in truth. And we get a small glimpse here in our text of what that means. Paul said, this is how I worship God. I worship God by believing the things written in the law and the prophets. We believe what God said in his word. We meaning believers. We being followers of the way. We believe what God said in his word. And then we do it. We carry out our lives. We behave in a way that shows what we believe. And when we do that, that is how we worship God. That's worship. That is how we show worth. That's what worship means, to show worth. That is how we show worth to God. That is, let's use another word, love. Love. Okay? Loving God. How do we show love to God? We keep his commandments. We believe, we hear, and we do the things that are taught in his word. That is worship. That is love. Paul says, they accuse me of heresy, but I don't believe anything different than what the Old Testament scriptures say. And those guys know it. How do I know this? Because they know that the scriptures speak of resurrection, which I believe. I believe in the resurrection, and they believe it too. Okay? Remember, there's Pharisees. The Sadducees didn't believe in resurrection. But there's Pharisees there as part of these elders, among these elders of the Sanhedrin. He says, they believe in the resurrection. I believe in the resurrection. We all know that the Old Testament speaks of this. Paul refers to this as the hope towards God. You see that in verse 15? The hope towards God. That word hope isn't talking about some wishful thinking. You know, like we might say, I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow. Okay? We don't say, I hope there's a resurrection. Okay? It's not that kind of hope. That's wishful thinking. Okay. There's an uncertainty to that. You see that? When we use hope in that kind of way, there's an uncertainty to it. We hope it happens. It might not, but we hope it does. Okay? That's not the meaning of the word hope here. This is the Greek word elpis. Elpis. It's from a verb that means to anticipate with pleasure. To anticipate with pleasure. This kind of hope is a joyful anticipation. Got that? A joyful anticipation. A confident expectation. Okay? This is like when you were a kid and you were waiting for Christmas Day. Okay? You don't just hope for Christmas Day. You know Christmas Day is coming. You know when Christmas Day comes, there's going to be presents under that Christmas tree, and hopefully, I won't take that back, I'm not going to use that word here. You know there's going to be presents under the tree, and you know that a number of them are going to have your name on it. You know it's going to happen. You don't just hope to get presents. You know for certain. You know for certain that it's coming, and you anticipate it with eagerness and excitement. This is the kind of hope that Paul is referring to. The resurrection is a certainty. And as believers of those things written in the scriptures, we look forward to the resurrection with a joyful, eager anticipation because we are certain of its happening. This word elpis is used 54 times in the New Testament. 54 times. And most of the time it's translated hope. But this idea of joyful anticipation, eager expectation, 54 times it appears in the New Testament. Let me give you some examples here. Titus chapter 1, verse 2, in hope of eternal life, which God that cannot lie promised before the world began. Not just wishful thinking, not just, I hope I have eternal life. No, the joyful anticipation of eternal life. Later on, a little further along in Titus chapter 2, Titus chapter 2, verse 13, looking for that blessed hope and the glorious appearing of the great God and our Savior, Jesus Christ, Christ's imminent return. Not just, oh, I hope Christ comes back. I really hope he comes back. No, the joyful anticipation of the return of Jesus Christ. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. You say, I don't see the word hope in that verse. Well, look again. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith. Underline that word faith. That's the word elpis. Joyful anticipation. Let us hold fast the profession of our joyful anticipation, our eager expectation, without wavering. And of course, the context there has to do with all these the dispersed Hebrews who are under tremendous persecution, knowing that knowing of all of God's promises and of eternal life and their salvation and the reward that was waiting for them. And Paul says, despite all of this that's going on, hold fast. Know what you've got to look forward to. That eager, earnest expectation that you've got waiting for you. Hold on to that. Okay? One more here. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which according to his abundant mercy hath begotten us again unto a lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. A joyful anticipation of the resurrection because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. There is a resurrection for us, for believers. And this verse is timely because it segues right back into our text here. You notice, excuse me, notice also that Paul makes a reference to two resurrections. He said there will be a resurrection of the just and unjust. Where you say, Andy, why does that mean two resurrections? Isn't everyone resurrected and then judged? And I might point out, okay, if that's the case, if there's only one resurrection, then we don't really know who's just and unjust, do we? Not until the judgment. So why does Paul then make this, how can Paul make this distinction if we don't know? But Paul does make the distinction. He makes the distinction here that being just or unjust is a present reality. And it's not merely a forensic or legal declaration. This has to do with identity. And at this year's conference, I'm going to be speaking about our identity as believers. The believer's identity. This is not just a declaration. This is what he is. Okay, this has to do with existence, okay, identity, reality, just or unjust. And so you have these two resurrections. And Paul says that we can be assured that this will happen. And then I read verse 16 in that last paragraph, but verse 16 actually belongs with the next paragraph because he says, and herein do I exercise myself. And that's rather a cumbersome translation. But what Paul is really saying there with that phrase, he's saying, Let me elaborate. Okay? So you see, he's making his defense before Felix, and he's refuted the charges with this summary statement of his. And so now he goes on to say, let me elaborate on this point. Let me explain it further to you what I mean. Because I intend to have a clear conscience before God and men. You see that expression, void of offense? That's an interesting statement. Void of offense. It's the Greek word aproskopos. Aproskopos. You have this prefix a, okay, which means no or not or without. You've heard Paul use the word anomia many times. Those of you who follow Paul's passing thoughts on his blog, you've heard Paul speak many times about anomia. A meaning no law. Okay, so this prefix a means no or none or not. Okay, it's got a negative to it. And then you have the word proskopto. Proskopto, which means, now let's get this. Proskopto means to strike at or surge against. Now picture this. The idea here would be like standing in a fast-flowing creek. Okay, you ever do that when you were a kid? If you've got a creek by your house that's rushing pretty fast, I've done this before, and you try to walk upstream against the current. What happens? Don't you kind of, you can feel the current pushing back against you. It's hard to do, isn't it? Walking upstream against that current, walking against to surge, to get this idea of surging against. That's where this meaning comes in. The picture creates trying to walk upstream against the water current, okay? Surging against. Okay? The other idea here, to cause to trip or to stub your toe on. Okay? Now, you are probably familiar with the New Testament expression. You've heard Jesus referred to as a rock of offense, right? Or a stumbling block. Okay? A rock of offense or a stumbling block. Now this is interesting. This actually refers to a paving stone. You know, all the roads and walkways were paved with stones, weren't they? And the engineers, as they're laying down these stones, are going to take great care to make sure that all the stones are even and level. And what happens is sometimes you get one that comes out of place. One kind of pops up a little bit, doesn't it? It kind of sticks up about an inch. Or have you ever been walking down the sidewalk and there's a tree growing there and the tree root pushes up the sidewalk on one side and heaves up a section of the sidewalk. And if you're not paying attention, you trip on that. You catch your toe on it, don't you? And you trip and you stumble. Okay? And you ever see somebody, what do people usually do? You ever see, watch somebody when they trip over something? What do? They turn around and they say, "That stupid sidewalk." They blame the sidewalk. They get offended at the sidewalk. They get offended at the thing that tripped them up, don't they? And so that's the idea behind this idea of proskopto, something that causes you to trip or to stumble and you become offended at it. Okay? Something that causes you to stumble or fall. Something that causes you to doubt. Okay? Jesus referred to, when he was teaching during his time on earth, when he was teaching, he said that he would cause many to be offended. Many would be offended because of him. And that's that same word here, proskopto, referring to something that causes you to stumble or trip, to doubt what you believe. Okay? It trips you up in a manner of speaking. So Paul uses this word here, and he uses it with the prefix ah in front of it. I don't want there to be any stumbling block. I want to be void of offense. I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to have anybody to have reason to accuse me. I want to set the record straight so that there is no doubt, so that my conscience is clear. You got that? Do you understand the scope of what he's saying here with this? No one's going to accuse me of not being clear on this matter. No one's going to accuse me of being deceptive. And so then he goes on to elaborate. Look at verse 17. Verse 17. Now after many years, and Paul's still speaking here. Now after many years, I came to bring my alms to my nation and offerings. Okay? This was Pentecost. That's the whole reason he's coming. Was the observance of Pentecost. You remember earlier he said, I've only been here 12 days. And now he says, it's been years since the last time I've been to Jerusalem. And I've only been here 12 days. So this is kind of him reiterating that idea. I have come to bring alms to my nation and offerings, whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult. It was just him and those four other guys that attend the vow, remember? Okay, so these Jews from Asia found him. And then he says, these Jews from Asia, who ought to have been here before thee and object if they had aught against me. Okay, says, where are these Jews from Asia? Why aren't they here? They're the ones who brought the initial accusation. Where are they? They're the ones who are accusing me. They need to be here. If they have an objection, they need to bring it. Where are they? Verse 20. Or else, let these same hear, the high priest and the Sanhedrin, let these hear, say, if they have found any evil doing in me, while I stood before the council. And this is a reference back to last week's lesson where Claudius Lysias, the Roman captain, made that provision to have a hearing there in his own little courtroom, as it were. He made arrangements for the high priest and the chief priest and the elders to come hear and hear what Paul had to say. And while they were there, did they find any accusation against Paul? That's what he's saying here. Verse 21. Except it be for this one voice, this one thing that I cried standing among them, concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day. There is only one declaration that I made when I was with them before Lysias, and it had to do with the resurrection. The reason I'm here today. Do you realize this whole thing could have been cleared up 5 days ago? But then this dispute with the resurrection happened. So Paul's case is, they have nothing on me. They can't prove any of their charges. The Jews from Asia who started all this trouble aren't here. They're not here to testify. I didn't do any things they accused me of. If I'm guilty of anything, it is that I believe in the resurrection. And there are those among them, referring to those the high priest and the Sanhedrin that are there right now. There are those among them who do not believe in the resurrection. This is what this whole dispute is over. Now let's look at this last paragraph in our text. And then we'll be done for tonight. Verse 22. And when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them and said, when Lysias the chief captain shall come down, I will know the utmost of your matter. He commanded a centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty and that he should forbid none of his acquaintances to minister or come unto him. A more perfect knowledge of that way. Now, the word here for perfect is not the word that means mature. It is the word akrobos. Akrobos. And it means exact or accurate. Exact or accurate. So after hearing Paul's testimony, Felix now has more accurate knowledge. He has a better understanding of the way. Again, there's that reference to believers, followers of the way. Felix understands it better now as a result of Paul's testimony. So Felix declares a recess. He says, I'm not going to make any decision until Lysias can be here to testify. As you remember, that Tertullus brought accusations against Lysias, saying that he interfered with the Jews' lawful attempt at bringing Paul to justice for allegedly profaning the temple. And so Felix obviously wants to hear his testimony about what happened that day. He said, I will know the utmost of this matter. He says, once I hear Lysias' testimony, I will then know the utmost of this matter. And that's just another way of saying, I'm going to investigate this thoroughly. I'm going to investigate this thoroughly. And we're going to learn later that Felix does have other motives. He is motivated by other things. We learn that, among other things, that he's actually hoping for a bribe to help influence his decision. That's the kind of individual that he was. But despite that, nevertheless, we see, you look at Felix here, he seems to be a very fair judge, doesn't he? Just like Gallio was in Corinth, in the province of Achaia. He's willing to hear all sides. And at the same time, notice he gives Paul the kind of treatment due to a Roman citizen. You know, he's still in custody, but he has much freedom there in Caesarea, doesn't he? He has a centurion guarding him. And that's the same idea there as before, guarding him for the purpose of protection. Okay, but and Paul is free to come and go. He has liberty. And he can even have friends and family come visit him. Okay? So once again, we see the significance here that Paul's citizenship plays in all of this. Okay? So that brings us to the end of this lesson tonight. And I'll say this again, you know, for those of you who are listening, if you'd like to be a part of the program, the phone number again is 347-855-8317. We have a caller waiting. I'm going to assume this is Paul. I don't recognize the number. I'm going to assume this is Paul, but I'm going to bring the caller on here. Hello, caller. You are on the air.
It is us.
All right, it is Paul. Is Susan with you tonight?
Yes.
All right, hi Susan. Glad you could be here.
Hi. I'm glad to be here too.
All right. Paul, go ahead, Paul. What do you have to say?
Well, not much. Thanks for the lesson. I'll just throw in a few observations. What Pope Paul focused on, and we talked a lot about this when we were heavy into the book of Romans, is the gospel of first importance versus the full counsel of God. And Paul refers to the full counsel of God here. I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written by the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. And, you rightly pointed out that that refers to two different resurrections and two different just judgments as well. As I wrote an article just today, as a matter of fact, your eschatology should match your soteriology.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, one resurrection, one judgment goes hand in glove with progressive justification, and the fusion of gift and reward, while separate resurrections and judgment leave room for separating gift and reward, makes them separate. And again, this whole issue of Christians not being under the law and therefore will not be attending a judgment where there is law. So, again, thanks for pointing that out. And then basically, you know, I would just point out that it's worthy to note that Paul describes worship as believing everything written by God. Worship is believing the full counsel of God and applying it to your life.
Exactly.
So that's all in there in those few verses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's Paul has this unique gift of saying a lot with a few words.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he does. And anyway, that's all I have to add. Susan might have something to add.
When I was, when Paul and I were dating, he used to remind me and the boys that worship, again, is not a place. He always would comment on those sanctuaries that had, you know, enter to worship,
yeah,
exit to serve, or something like that. And Paul would always remind us that, he said, you know, worship is how I treat my wife every day of the week. That's true worship.
Mm-hmm.
So it's worship is an acting upon what God has said in His Word and making it a vibrant part of your life every day. It's living out the Word of God in your sanctification, and that others can see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. That's worship, not a building made with hands and not a set day and time of the week. It should really preoccupy our time throughout the entire day.
Traditionally in Protestantism, worship is returning to the same gospel that saved you afresh. And you know, worship is only those things that result in the imputation and experience of Christ's righteousness. So that's huge. And of course, the Jews were pretty focused on worship only taking place at the temple and in places. So
worship in that context seemed to revolve exclusively around ritual.
Mm-hmm.
You're performing a particular ritual, and in performing some ritual, you are in that sense showing worship, and that carries over today to modern church going. The whole act of going to church and everything that is involved is so ritualistic. Even those that would claim to have a what they would call a contemporary worship, you know, it's still there's still very much a ritual to it, whether you know the whole liturgy behind it, and somehow performing that liturgy of the ritual, that is worship, and it's not.
It imparts grace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm going to be talking about that during the conference when I get into my second question. You know, the whole thing of going to church for the sole purpose of the, quote, their words, impartation of grace.
Mm-hmm.
Well, grace in their dictionary, theological dictionary, is really the same thing as righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Going to church and, you know, going to church and basically, you know, basically it boils down to this. The praise and worship music of the neo-Calvinist movement didn't just happen, okay? It just didn't happen. And of course, people are really bad at, you know, thinking that things just happen in a vacuum, and they don't. The whole thing with the praise and worship movement and the resurgence of authentic Protestantism was what John Piper calls exaltation, or basically the vivification part of mortification and vivification. So when it boils right down to it, you go to church, as Dr. Michael Horton put it, you go to church to, quote, kill and make alive. Okay? Kill and make alive. All right.
Mm.
And I like the way Luther put it. The way Luther put it, you go to church to be brought down to hell.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay. So that you can experience resurrection. Okay. And I must say, my experience as a church-going Protestant since 1983 to when I quit going to the institutional church 3 or 4 years ago, I gotta say, going to church for the purpose of being brought down to hell is fairly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to be crap.
Huh? It's depressing, too.
Well, yeah, you know, and, you know, more and more, Susan and I, when we get opportunities to counsel, we're just telling people, stop talking about sin so much. Everything isn't about sin. No, we're not going to go through a big, long list of what's wrong with you and what's wrong with him. Well, no, we're not going to do that. Y'all just go home and love each other, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Our focus is not sin. Focusing on sin isn't going to cover a multitude of sins. Peter
mm-hmm.
said that love covers a multitude of sins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you all would sin against each other so much if you were busy loving each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so...
Yeah, exactly right.
You know, yeah, this whole thing, you know, the focus on sin, you know. But anyway, I guess that's a rabbit track, but, you know, worship, yeah, worship in spirit and truth, like you said, and we meet to encourage each other unto more worship.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really per se meet together as Christians to worship.
Mm-mm.
we're supposed to be doing that all week long. We meet together to encourage each other unto good works and to equip ourselves to worship better.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
You're right on there.
You're right. Yeah. So anyway, that's all I've got to add.
Okay. Any more comments or questions from Susan there?
No, Andy, not tonight, but again, it was a good lesson, and I really appreciated the reminder about what true worship was.
Well, and thank you.
Okay, and
mainly because I'm so bogged down with Jonathan Edwards that it's refreshing to have a talk and a lesson that is not designed to remind me of how unworthy I am to walk on the face of this earth.
So. Well, Susan, hey, God bless you. I don't know how, Susan, God bless you. I don't know how you can, I don't envy the task that you have of trying to prepare that a lesson like that for the conference. I can imagine you just gotta, man, by the time you get done, you just want to, like, you know, take a bath. I feel like I got filth all over me. I'm tired of this depressing, bringing me down, you know, kind of talk. It's just like, you just need a ray of sunshine after that, I guess. And
absolutely.
I don't know how you do it. But thank you for all your efforts thank you for doing all that work for us so that we don't have to get down in the mud and do it.
Well, it is discouraging to read through his sermons, and sometimes I really weep after reading some of his sermons and thinking, if I were sitting out in the audience listening to mm-hmm. this, no wonder his uncle went out and slit his throat and out of despair. And how people, John Piper and some of the others of that ilk, elevate this man to the level of the Apostle Paul. That's one of the quotes that I've heard. Because when I read the epistles that Paul wrote, I do not read much about damnation. I read about, in the epistles, this lively life we have
mm-hmm.
in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul commending other saints and calling on them to be honored.
Right.
It's inspiring, it's encouraging, it's uplifting, it's exhortation, it's consoling, it's edifying.
Right.
And you know, you got it, you know, I listened to a John MacArthur clip today. And, you know, he said, you know, the problem with Arminianism and anybody who's not a Calvinist, and this is a quote, they do not see the sin even in their good works. Okay? You know, that's John MacArthur Jr. Now, where does that come from? That comes straight out of the Heidelberg Disputation.
Yeah.
Okay? If you've been following along at all, you know that comes straight out of the Heidelberg Disputation. Okay? And Luther's worldview. Okay? And this is John MacArthur Jr. All right? So, like, during one of my sessions, you know, and this is just fact, but during one of my sessions, I'm going to play video clips, news clips, okay, of these acts that people did, okay, like the guy that saved the 2-year-old that had drowned, okay? This young boy that coming home from McDonald's that saved this lady who was shot in the head and run over by her boyfriend, okay, and intervened and drug her in the car, and, the 911 tape is playing, and this 16-year-old kid telling her, hang on, hang on. And she's like saying, you can't let me die. You can't let me die. And he's going, I am not going to let you die. I am not going to let you die. And so he's on the phone with 911. He took her to his grandparents' house. Him and his grandparents stopped the bleeding until the paramedics got there, saved her life. I'm going to play like 3 or 4 of those clips, and I'm going to say, in Luther's worldview, what those people did, forget whether or not they're Christians or not. Let's assume that both of these, the young man and this other guy, let's assume that they're Christians, okay? They might as well be in Luther's worldview. In Luther's worldview, what those two people did is utterly evil. And if they think what they did is good, they are going to hell. Okay? That's Luther's worldview. Okay? And if you've been following the Heidelberg Disputation, you know the difference between Luther's construct of venial and mortal sin. Okay? If you think everything you do, good or bad, is mortal sin, your sins qualify to be forgiven at your local friendly Reformed church. Okay? So, this is irrefutable. This is the worldview that we're dealing with. And just today, listening to a video, John MacArthur Jr. says it, okay? The problem with non-Calvinists is, quote, they don't see the sin in their good works. And, of course, this whole boils, back to the law being the standard for justification, and the law can't be kept perfectly. So, we've got, Tank has a lot of work ahead of it. There is nothing out there that is challenging this, and if you watch these conferences and think about how they're drawing our young people in and stealing our young people away en masse, how can people not stand up? I can tell you I'm going to stand up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The laity needs to stand up and create a whole nother body of theology that speaks directly against and supplies a solid alternative to orthodoxy. That's, mm-hmm. I believe, the calling of Tank.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, all of that just, I guess, sparked from what Paul says concisely in these few verses.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Andy,
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said, I have something I need to do. I think it starts with Jonathan and ends with Edward. So I want to say goodnight.
All right. Well, yeah. Thank you, Susan. God bless you. Thank you for your comments, all your input. I appreciate it. I always love what you have to bring to the program, and in all your insightful comments and observations.
Before I forget to ask you, how did her voice sound?
Susan's?
Yeah, tonight. How did her voice sound?
As far as I could tell, she sounded like she always does. Is that a good
okay,
thing?
Okay, I'm testing equipment.
Okay.
I'm testing equipment. What I'm looking for is how clear we sound when we're talking.
Well, I notice you, your voice, you're obviously closer to the microphone, but I did notice a little bit difference in the tonal quality. You sound a little bit more fuller tonight,
yeah.
And less, not as, less thin. So what, did you get a new microphone or something?
Well, I did. And we got to get you one as well. It's the kind of microphone that we should be using for our broadcasts. Did Susan sound like she was in the background or
no?
A little
better. She just sounded like she was on speakerphone as usual.
Okay,
but I could hear her
all
fine.
Right. Yeah, she was about 15 feet away. So this is the microphone that we're going to be using during the conference for live feed on Blog Talk Radio. So
okay,
we're not going
to
be able to do all of the talks live, but most of them.
Right. Well, sounds good. Well, Paul, thanks again for being part of the program tonight, for your comments and all your good input on this, and all the work that you and Susan are doing there with Tank Ministries. And I'm glad to be a part of it with you. So,
well, we're delighted. We're delighted as well, and more than delighted that with everybody working together for our common goal. And so with that, we'll say goodnight, and thanks again for your hard work in the Book of Acts, Andy.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. All right, then. Well,
alrighty.
You have a good evening.
Good night.
We'll talk to you later. Good night. Bye-bye.